Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find the Commonwealth Club online, as I believe you've been told. Now, I don't know about you, but when I've had a bad day, I like to go onto the internet, and I like to watch footage of tonight's guest owning a conservative piece of ideology. I find it, yeah. I find it restorative and inspiring. I think there's the voice of the Rachel Maddow Show to me is the voice that all of us overeducated leftist geeks have in our heads, right? Like, that's what we think we sound like when we're stumbling our way through political discussion. In fact, I think the only time I've ever won a political argument is when I'm quoting Rachel Maddow and pretending that it just kind of occurred to me. So her erudition and wit are now available in convenient book form. This is Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power, which is a powerfully intelligent and intelligently powerful book. It's a real book also. Now I'm damning with faint praise almost, but when they asked me to do this event several months ago, they said, so Maddow has a book out, and I kind of assumed the book was like, I'm Rachel Maddow and Stuff I Think by Rachel Maddow, you know, and I wouldn't have begrudged her, I would have read that happily. But this is a powerfully argued and researched piece of material. Her picture's not even on the cover, is what a real book it is. You have to, yeah. You actually have to turn it over, try this. And there she is, along with a quote from what Roger Ailes, the CEO of Fox News, what's going on? Let's find out, Rachel Maddow! Yeah! Look at her!
Oh, that was so funny.
This is amazing. I'm from here. This yeah. is like, you know.
What do you see here? Do you remember what you see at the Castro Theater? What made you gay?
Whatever I saw. Whatever I saw here was a little blurry.
Ooh.
Yeah.
All right.
You know what I mean?
I know yeah. your parents are here, so we don't have to talk about
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Let's get right into them. Yeah. And my mother, so I don't even know why I brought it up. The whole thing is...
It's a myopia joke. So I didn't have my glass? Never
no.
mind.
All right. So this book is... I find this book kind of embarrassingly smart and well-conceived.
Thank
you. Because it's... I was kind of embarrassed to read it and realize that I just assumed that someone who sits at a desk and talks for a living, however righteous, is not going to write a book. Like a real book. I've read books. I don't mean to diss compatriots of yours, but I've read a book by Bill O'Reilly. I have. And I've read a book by Keith Olbermann, and I've read like three sentences of a book by Glenn Beck. And this is a whole different shebang.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you asked, you know, Tom Brokaw, why didn't you write a book about a specific topic where you well-researched and developed it, he would say, that's not really my gig. So is this your gig? What is your gig? What do you do for a living?
I got the book contract before I had the TV show.
Ooh.
I did have a radio show at the time, but I did. You, yeah, you were the
that
one.
That was the listener.
Yeah, exactly. It worked out great between you and me. You didn't buy enough gold. That's an AM talk radio joke. Sorry. And so it wasn't like I had a show that was
doing well or poorly or indifferent, and I wanted to amplify from the show in book form. I wanted to write a book because I had this idea about the country that I felt like I kept trying to get at it in the types of broadcasting that I was doing on a radio show and then guesting on other people's TV shows and then eventually hosting TV. And this argument was just took longer to say than could be done well in a broadcast format. So, I mean, the whole reason that I do TV and the whole reason that I did radio is that I have these ideas about what's going on in the world, and I like to explain things. And this is something that I wanted to explain. It was an argument that I wanted to make that I really felt like there was no way to do it other than in print, in long form, and so therefore I had to write a book. But I didn't want to write a book for a book's sake. Does that make sense?
I'm with you. No. And the idea, if I'm going to try to say it and then you're going to say it, is that the founding of this nation had in it some mechanisms that made it difficult to go to war, and we have circumvented them. And by we, I mean not us. don't blame me. But these devices have been circumvented in order to make it easier and to isolate war, in effect.
Yeah. I am not an originalist. I'm not a person who thinks that the world is just like it was in the 1700s, that we have to do everything the way that exactly the founders meant. They didn't have very smart things, for example, to say about intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Let's just say.
Right. Women voting and stuff. I mean, there's some things that just hadn't occurred. But I do think that it is foundational to this country that the colonists were very upset about being required to help the British Empire's military adventures. So there's a lot of colonial consternation over the fact that there's too many freaking wars, and the colonists felt put upon to finance them. I mean, why is that quartering soldiers? You don't have to quarter soldiers thing in our foundational documents. It's because that was one of the things that we were really, really annoyed with. And so if we had not been annoyed by too much war and the necessity of paying for it, we might not have been a country in the first place. And because of that concern, the founders structured the Constitution in a way that was designed not to make us pacifist, and we never were. I mean, we did fight a war to make ourselves as a country. We're never designed to be pacifist, I don't think, but we were designed to be sort of deliberately peaceable, that peacetime would be normal and war would be an aberration. And they specifically put war-making powers in the Constitution, not under the executive, but under the legislature, with the full knowledge that the legislature can often not get its act together. That it is a group of people that has to make big...
That's so flattering, you would say often.
Yeah. They said, you know, listen, that we think that essentially it is a kingly oppression to wage war at the whim of one person, and kings are prone to that, and we don't want a kingly system, and we're going to put, with studied care, we are going to vest the questions of war and peace in the legislature, because they are not as likely to make a dumb decision to go to war, if only because they'll actually have to make an argument. They can't just assert that we're going, they have to defeat one another in argument in a legislative body. And that bias, that disinclination toward war, is not, you know, it's not a perfect prescription. It doesn't tell us what to do in every instance. But I do think that's how they meant us to be inclined as a nation. And that creates a lot of hassle for presidents who want to wage wars. And as presidents have come up with ways to get around those hassles, we've kind of let them do that. And now we are in a position in 2012 in which there's way too many workarounds for the things that were supposed to impede a president bent on war.
Now, where do you see, this is something, your book touches several times upon something that has confused me since I first learned about it in eighth grade at Herbert Hoover Middle School. We all remember Miss Corsilia, right? We were there. And it's a conflict in my mind between that we have a president who's a commander-in-chief of the armed forces, mm-hmm. and then a legislative branch that's doing war. Because even when I was in eighth grade, I thought, what's the use of being in command of the armed forces if you don't get to go to war? What do you... You design the parades? You know, what's the gig? And you chronicle this. I mean, one of my favorite parts is there's the conversation between Ted Kennedy and Dick Cheney. I mean, quite a contentious conversation, mm-hmm. that, you know, that I was also sumo wrestling in my head. And precisely between that. And how do you see What is that difference?
Well, when I say it's not an exact prescription, I think that's one of the things that's true about that. I mean, declaring war is Congress's prerogative. But we go to war without declaring war all the time. And there are commander-in-chief powers that I think even the founders envisioned. They would talk about things like having the power to repel invasion. You know, something happens, all of a sudden you need to act quickly. Congress is all in the 1700s equivalent of the Bahamas or whatever.
Right.
And so we need to do something. The president has sort of temporal and limited, temporally limited ability to make decisions about national security. But it is meant to be, an exception. And it's not meant to be the rule. And it's meant to be a time-limited thing. Congress is expected to make the decisions. It doesn't mean that the president has no authority, but it does mean that he's got to defer to Congress on the larger issues of war and peace. And so does that always mean it has to be a declaration of war? We have evolved in our national security state so that there almost never is one.
Right.
And now it's an authorization of the use of military force and all of these other things. If we're lucky. And I'm not even so sure that it matters what you call it. But what I think was intended was the idea that it's Congress's call. And that if Congress says no, it doesn't happen. And we've seen that happen even in modern times. It's not an ancient idea. Gerald Ford wanted to go back and start the Vietnam War again after we were gone, and Congress said no, and Democrats and Republicans said no, and when he still wanted to go, and he was very upset, he said he was horrified by their reaction, they not only said no, they used appropriations, they used money to say no, we're not going to give you a nickel to do it. And that wasn't very long ago, that was Gerald Ford. So we have done stuff like this even in modern times. I think the debate before Gulf War I, which is in there at length, we don't remember having had, I think, a lot of national consternation about the balance of power heading into that war, but it ended up being a totally robust, interesting debate that I think made the whole country pay a lot more attention and be a lot more invested in that war. So there are examples of people doing it right, even in modern times.
Sure. Now, part of the it seems to me that part of I keep wanting to say reach around. Maybe it's only because I'm in the Castro Theater. Part of going around the blockades in favor of war is precisely because of this temporal power, it seems to me. And it seems that you talk about in your book the kind of ratcheting up, so it's always an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always have to rush back and we have to decide in 2.5 hours and there's hardly any time to address the American people, let alone have a debate on war. And do you think some of that is media driven, Ms. Media woman? I mean, it seems to me that there's, you know, it used to be you could read the newspaper every morning, and now the newspaper's already saying things that you already learned because you were checking it when you were bored at work. Do you think that's part of what builds an emergency state is this kind of drumbeat of that we see what's, you know, when they invaded Kuwait, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, we saw that on TV.
Yeah.
We could see that happening. And that made it seem it made everyone, I think, less in the mood to have a long conversation about whether or not we should do something about it.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't actually think it's even I don't think it's just a modern dynamic. I think that because there's an imbalance of information between people who are operating at sort of high-level national security positions and the rest of us, they can always say, as Reagan did regularly, for example, that they had secret information that if they could tell us,
yeah,
we would be just as horrified as they are, but we have to trust them that the urgency is there. We'll tell you later. And so they can always do that. They can always tell you that things are more urgent than they want to be, and we don't have the information that they've got. I mean, particularly when it's stuff that's not actual wars, when it's conflict with transnational actors like terrorist groups. In that case, their actions or their threats are things that the intelligence community has, that spies have, and that we don't have access to, and very few members of Congress do. So there is an imbalance of information, but I think that ultimately what we have to count on is winning the argument. Having to win the argument forces you to make a good argument. If all you have to do is assert that there is a great danger and there's a great imperative that we need to act, and you're the one who gets to then decide if we're going to act,
right,
doesn't matter what you say. You don't even have to deliberately lie. You can just skew it the way that you see it. But if you actually have to persuade other people who don't automatically agree with you of the rightness of your cause and then win a vote on it, your argument will be better, will be forced to be better. You'll be forced to say more of what it is. And that process is designed to make bad arguments lose so we don't do bad things justified by dumb arguments. I know, it's silly.
It felt like an applause moment.
Where's the guy with the flashing sign that says applause?
Now, what that points to is a certain level of dishonesty that goes on in American political discourse. Shocking, I know. Now, I was watching some of your recent programs, and there, it was yet another moment where it seemed to me you were doing such a fantastic job, and that it was depressing to me that the bar was so low. Mm. And that it was, you were going through various statements that Mitt Romney had made, and you were calling them, what's the word I'm looking for, lies. And because they were not true. And they were things that weren't true that you would have to know weren't true in order to even know to say them. So they're definitely lies. And again, depressing that makes you the really exciting show. Do you know what I mean? It just, that seems sad to me. But one thing that I quoted you, I had to scroll back YouTube, which is hard, and find the right thing so I could quote it. And it said, and you said, some dishonesty in national American politics is frankly routine, which is not shocking news. But when you are thinking about matters of national security and international matters, it seems like what, I mean, I have some level of believing Jack Nicholson and A Few Good Men, of like, you don't want to know the truth. You can't handle the truth. Is there some level of dishonesty that you think is necessary with the American people or acceptable with the American people when we're talking about decisions like this?
Ooh. I think that there are people who are in positions of power on these matters who think that they are doing the country a favor by lying to us. And I think that is part of the problem with this idea that national security matters should be decided by this sort of insulated technocratic cabal of people who we're not serious enough to communicate with.
Right.
And that's sort of how we think about foreign policy. I mean, there is sort of a nice bipartisan sounding element of it, which is that we shouldn't fight about these things, we shouldn't talk about these things, leave these things to the professionals. I sort of think that the more important something is, the more probable it is that we should fight about it. Because I think that fighting about stuff is a way of ferreting out bad arguments. So I think that it is a cardinal sin to lie to the American people about war. I think that doesn't mean that it's unexpected, but I would hope that we don't get so cynical about it that when people get caught out for doing that, we think of it as politics as usual. I mean, war is more serious than regular politics. National security is more serious than regular politics, not just because of sometimes you're talking about existential threats that affect all of us, but because when you're talking about any kind of intervention, any type of use of force anywhere in the world, people are conceivably going to die for it. And on purpose, because we put them there for that purpose. And
there are usually people there already.
And there
are those people, too.
There are those people, too, yeah. And we, you know, I think that there is a certain, you're talking about, you know, it's not us, we're not the ones who made the mistake. And I think that, I do think that's right. I don't think you and I caused the drift that I'm writing about in the book. But, you know, there is something that bothers me about it, which is that I think about our collective responsibility for it. I think that one of the things that's happened is that we've made it easier to go to war, not just to get around Congress, not just to get around political constraints, not just to get around, like, budget concerns. Oh, say it's going to be free. Give people a tax cut. Just don't put it in the budget. Say it's an emergency supplemental. We've come up with all of these ways to get around what would be political constraints on war, but one of the biggest constraints we've got around is that the people of the United States might be upset. And so we don't necessarily know that contractors are out there doing stuff in our name and fields of battle. We don't necessarily know who they are or think of them as connected to us when they get hurt or when they get killed. We don't necessarily feel like we can control whether or not we go to war. If the president wants to, we're gonna. And if the president doesn't want to, we're not going to. We don't feel like we have any control over whether or not we come home from war. I mean, the New Washington Post ABC poll today said a grand total of 30% of the American public thinks the Afghanistan war is worth fighting. I mean, even a majority of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents want that war over.
Yeah.
But we don't feel like we have any say in whether or not it's over. And that is on us.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the notion of when a war is over has just changed.
Yeah.
And maybe this is only through the rosy glow of history that maybe it was always thus. But it seems to me...
Well, they end a lot slower now than they used to.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in our 11th year in Afghanistan, the longest war in American history, simultaneously fought an 8.5-year-long war in Iraq while that 11-year Afghanistan
war was going on. And that war ended, you know, 27 times.
Yeah. And when it really did end, when we really did leave in December, the reaction here was, oh, is that still going on? I think that because we think of National Guardsmen and reservists as essentially full-time troops now, like they've been deployed so much now, we think of them almost as active duty. They're so separate from civilian life that we don't have that sense of, oh, the guard is coming home.
Yeah.
Because we don't notice what we are paying for, because we think that the military is fighting war is not on their own and sort of not that the country is at war, the wars can just kind of go on indefinitely. There's no friction. And I think that is part of why the wars get longer. We also, I think, have started to think about the military as being kind of superhuman, having any capability that we want to give them to. When you end up devoting that much of your budget to a resource like that for decades, they probably should be superhuman by now.
One would think, yeah.
If we'd funded schools like that, we'd be, you know, we'd be big thinkers. But if you think the military can do anything, then you assign them impossible tasks and expect them to stay until that impossible thing is done, and then you have 11-year wars.
Well, and your book chronicles several even well-meaning attempts, it seems, to have gentler activities as part of military action, as part of the budget for the war. And it's disheartening to see how badly that goes. I mean, you have, early on in the book, which I've conveniently marked with a post-it, you described the Fallujah water treatment plant, which cost $108 million and doesn't really work very well. And that you say, $100 million American dollars partially diverted to the groups fighting U.S. troops to build poorly a giant, unwanted wastewater treatment project that provides nothing but the big stink for 3/4 of the city. No one would argue that something like this is a good use of U.S. tax dollars, but it is, in fact, what we bought.
Yeah.
Now, a challenge that seems to me is that I think a water treatment plant in Fallujah, given what we've trooped through in Fallujah, is like a great thing to spend money on. Once we got there and leveled the place, it seems like building it up is good, and what's disheartening is that it costs so much it doesn't work. It doesn't seem to me that inherently trying to do some good in a land where we've stomped on it pretty hard is bad, but it seems to me that you make less of a distinction between that, and is that because it goes so badly, or why is that?
I think it's an important question. I think we're sort of in the post-counterinsurgency era now. Like, the military no longer says it's going to do counterinsurgency. That's the whole nation-building idea. Because we've decided that we don't want to structure our military so that we can have hundreds of thousands of troops in foreign places that don't want us there for decades while we build up their infrastructure.
Right.
Meanwhile, you know, Detroit falls into a giant sinkhole.
Yeah.
We've decided that we don't want our military to be like that anymore. And then that leaves the question, well, okay, do we believe in international development work? Because we were sort of doing international development work under the guise of waging war. And it didn't work very well. I mean, the Fallujah wastewater treatment plant, maybe the people of Al-Anbar province would like Fallujah to have a working water treatment plant, but that was not their priority. It was not built by Iraqi companies. The subcontractors that were hired out by the American contractors that did it ended up, in a lot of cases, diverting the money to the insurgency that was fighting the U.S. troops. It's us going in there and telling them what they want, building it for them, and hoping they'll like us for it.
Yeah.
And maybe sometimes that works. And I want everybody to have access to clean water and good sewage facilities. But is that the right way to wage war? And who argued for that $108 million? and who won the argument against competing arguments that $108 million should be used for something else. We don't treat Pentagon dollars like they are the same kind of dollars as other dollars. That they don't have to actually compete on equal footing with either non-military spending or even within the military budget on what might be spent.
Right.
It's a technocratic thing. There's no political argument about it. You have to defer to whoever is going to make these decisions on a technocratic ground. There's no partisanship about it. There's no fighting about it. There's no politics about it. And there's no national notification about it. So we didn't even know that happened until it was done. That insulation of those, this big an institution operating with that little fighting about it is always bad news.
I quite agree. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that seemed like an applause line too, but it didn't happen. People are too depressed. But so I'll move on to the part about mercenaries. That'll cheer everybody
up.
Oh,
yeah.
Because that, I don't even really know how to begin with that. The mercenary chapter for me was most fascinating and also the most distressing.
It's
and
the
it
most
was,
horrifying stuff.
When I was grateful it was in book form rather than TV form, so you can kind of put it aside and then lay your head on the table of cafe floor for a few minutes. You saw me. and when is your sense that that began to get so completely out of control that we have private companies? I mean, it's even just impossible for me to imagine that men and two women, I guess, but mostly men going over and being neither under the law of the country they're in nor under United States law and behaving unspeakably abominably, which I had trouble getting over, kind of. Because I could picture I might end up somewhere where I was neither under U.S. law nor the law of the country I was in, and I wouldn't think, like, well, now it's time for me to get a 14-year-old hooker. You know, that just wouldn't be my first thing I would do.
Yeah, but that is what happened. it was a very convenient, a convenient falling through the cracks. So if you're working for a U.S. military operation, but you are working not for the U.S. military, and you are abroad and you are peeling potatoes or driving trucks or fixing helicopters or whatever it is on a contract, you can't, if you do something wrong, if you kill somebody or whatever, you can't be tried under the Uniform Code of Military Justice because you are not in the military. Seems reasonable. The deal with the contract is that you can't be charged under the local laws in the place that you are serving because we can't have that. We can't have these local police officers and law enforcement interfering with our contractors while they're doing this thing for our military. And what U.S. court is going to prosecute things that happen on in the Balkans somewhere to somebody who is working on behalf of the U.S. government in a military theater? I mean, a U.S. court deciding that's their jurisdiction is also very hard to imagine. And in a sort of in that sort of legal free fire zone, all sorts of really bad stuff happens and happened from the very beginning. I mean, we've always had some private companies involved in making war. We've always been somebody profiteering. There's always been some contracts associated with military operations. But what they decided in the 90s was that Dick Cheney was at the Defense Department then, and he decided that he would give a small contract. It was like a $4 million contract to a company that he knew, and the contract would be to research, to look into whether it might be possible to have some logistics that are done now by uniformed members of the military, things like peeling potatoes, driving convoys, security for VIPs, building roads, barracks, running the kitchens and the PXs on the bases, all of that kind of stuff. Couldn't that be done in a privatized way? Couldn't some company do that? And this little company that got the $4 million contract looked into it and decided that, yes, it could be done,
yes,
but only they could do it. Which is how Dick Cheney picked himself as vice president, too, remember?
Yeah.
George W. Bush said, who could be my vice president? I've looked into it. And yeah, you're looking at him. It's the same deal with Halliburton. And so after that little pilot project expanded into not just a private company doing a thing here and there for the military, but taking over the basic logistics of what it meant to deploy U.S. troops abroad. And very quickly, under the Clinton administration, very quickly that expanded so that not only are there, like, the helicopter mechanics, in the case of the sex slave ring, working for private companies, But also, when Bill Clinton ran up against political constraints so that he could not do militarily what he wanted to do in the Balkans, he wanted to arm and train the Croatians. And he couldn't do that. So, miraculously, a company called MPRI, full of former military officials and others, miraculously surfaced to get a contract to do this work that the U.S. government wanted, but did not want to take political responsibility for. And so, miraculously, this idea of who was going to peel the potatoes became who was going to train the Croatians. And all of a sudden, like a beautiful nonpartisan nexus was born of unaccountable, sort of free fire, lawless contractors who are making a lot of money and who can help elide all sorts of political constraints on what we want to do with our military. And that has been too attractive to any administration to get rid of. Bill Clinton and Hillary, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in 2008, campaigning for the Democratic nomination,
the
both said that they were going to get rid of contractors, essentially, in our overseas deployments. And that has not happened at all. But it doesn't mean that it couldn't be done. It's not like it's been like this forever. They started doing it like this in the 90s. The 90s, I mean, I'm old, but still, that wasn't that long ago. I mean, I can remember the 80s. We didn't have this in the 80s. We could go back. And, you know, you listen to people in Washington talk about that right now, and you would think that it has always been thus, that we've always had this many private contractors doing key things in the military. And it's not true. And it is reversible. And it's not that old. And it's not partisan.
You have a to-do list at the end of the book
yeah.
that would fix all these problems. Ma'am. And
it's very short.
Yeah. and I must say that despite the fact that it's happened very quickly, it also seemed, a lot of it seems completely intractable to me.
Mm.
It feels permanent just in the political reality. You know, when it says, for instance, going to war, being at war should be painful for the entire country from the start. And let's do away with the secret military. Let's quit asking the military to do things left best to our State Department or the Peace Corps. Our Guard and Reserves need to be the Guard and Reserves again. Just about when I try to picture a politician, any politician, campaigning on that or standing up and making that, it seems now impossible to me because the given the last two wars, one war that we're still in and the other war that's over, that the rhetoric around that when that happened was that if you dared say anything, like, it seems to me maybe it's costing a lot of money and not going so well, you were obviously a communist Muslim traitor. And when I try to imagine any politician saying, well, the first thing we're going to do is that the CIA is going to be a lot more transparent in its military operations, how's that going to go down?
Well, but, you know, like...
Much as I like a happy ending in a book.
you are known as Mr. Happy Book.
That, yeah.
This happens to Lemony Snicket, let's see. But that Washington Post ABC poll that I was talking about,
yeah.
A majority of Republicans say that the war in Afghanistan is not worth fighting. When Ron Paul used to campaign for president, he's been doing it for a while, he would say something anti-interventionist, something sort of isolationist
yeah.
in his Ron Paul Republican way. And the, like, six Ron Paul guys in the corner would start screaming wildly, and then they'd get kicked out, and everybody else would boo them and go, USA, USA. It's not like that anymore. I mean, even in the Republican field for presidential candidates this year, as fun as it was to watch, one of the things that was sort of, I think, sobering and really interesting about it was to hear them talk about Afghanistan, was to hear, you know, Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum, who's been very, very hawkish over his career, and sometimes Mitt Romney, depending on the day of the week, and always John Huntsman, and always Ron Paul talking about needing to get the troops home and then getting a big round of applause from a Republican, rather, in some cases, very rabid Republican audiences at those debates. And right now, I mean, there was a time in 2004 and 2000, I guess 2004, when George W. Bush was running for re-election at this point in the election campaign, if you looked at public opinion on the Iraq War then, it essentially exactly matched partisan affiliation.
Right.
If you were a Democrat, you were against it. If you were a Republican, you were for it, and that's that. It's not like that anymore. People just don't, it doesn't line up on partisan
terms.
Well, is that, I mean, is that just because someone else is in charge? That's what it seems like to me.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that there is a legitimate...
It just seems like there's a certain stripe of a Republican that if Barack Obama said, like, you know what, I like babies. They were like, ah, babies.
I will not argue with you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I do think that there is a libertarian inflected conservative Republican mindset which is horrified by Hillary Clinton going to Pakistan, being asked by journalism students, I think it was, about drone strikes that had happened very recently before she got there, and her saying, I can't discuss that. I think that is something that horrifies a lot of conservatives. And it ought to. I mean, if we are using the CIA as a branch of the military, first of all, we should have had a debate about that. We should have had a fight about whether or not we were going to do that. We didn't. It just happened. Second of all, that means that we now effectively have a secret military. We have a military with an air force, right, doing things, committing acts of war in Americans' names, and the elected officials who are directing that those things happen will not explain those things to the American people or even admit that they are happening, will not discuss them. We have a secret military. Now, we didn't have to have a secret military in order to become a superpower in the world. We did not have to have a secret military in order to win a lot of stuff that we've left long
I agree, past. But you're more of an historian than I am, but when I think of the history of places that have had a secret military and that have not had a secret military, it doesn't seem to me that they go on as normal but just manage to cut out the secret military part. Like, it seems more like they do away with the whole thing,
yeah.
Which I'm not advocating. That's what concerns me. I mean, it's what I always think about the Department of Homeland Security. What president is ever going to say, we don't need a Department of Homeland Security anymore?
But it's not that old. That's the thing, is that we didn't evolve into a secret military, you know, over a century. We didn't get the Department of Homeland Security from Abraham Lincoln. You know, we got this stuff recently under contested terms by people who made some bad decisions, in many cases admitting they were bad decisions now. And we can reverse those things, and we should. The national security politics shouldn't be beyond our reach, and it shouldn't be beyond partisan fighting. I think we should see those things as within our power. I mean, I won't belabor this more than I already have. But just on the issue of drones, like let's say we're not going to talk about whether or not drone warfare is an appropriate use of military force. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that we think that ought to continue. There ought to be drones used to kill people who the American government wants dead around the world. Let's [S2]
Sure. [S1]
Say, if you concede that point, I believe that even among the people who would concede that point, there is going to be a good argument about why that can't be the Air Force, why that has to be the CIA. I mean, the Air Force has drones. The Air Force also has a chain of command, and they also have public information officers. Does the CIA need to be doing all of these things? Operationally, the answer is no. There's no operational reason that the CIA has to be doing it. It is a legal reason. And so that means it's about accountability to us. And so we ought to be pressing that, I think. Anyway.
I'm with you. Yeah.
See, this wouldn't make good TV. This whole ranting about the drones and the CIA.
I don't know. There's some networks that seem to do pretty well on the ranting front. But it's true. I wouldn't watch.
Yeah. I would definitely listen to it on the radio.
And that way the nation goes. Yeah. To me, this brings up a point, and when anyone who knew I was going to be sharing a stage with you and asking you questions asked me to more or less ask you one version of this, which is, will you go out later? No. No. That was the other one. It seems that a lot of people who watch your show and love your show and enjoy your point of view are also suspicious of their own motives for loving your point of view and for loving your show. And Matt, there's... when you look at MSNBC and you hold it up against Fox News, that it seems like one thing that Fox News does very well is throw red meat to people who want that kind of red meat. And I'm often, sometimes I can't decide when I watch you doing something where I say, like, is this great journalism or is it just great journalism because she agrees with me? Is it just what I would say and so therefore I think she's real smart? Or, and then I'm wondering if that's something you grapple with, because when I see Glenn Beck do an imitation of Nancy Pelosi, I think, like, that's monstrous and it has no place on our national stage. And then when you use a funny voice about a GOP senator, I think, like, that's funny. And, like, kind of smart, you know?
I think about that all the time. And, you know, actually, one of the things that's been good about going out in the world and talking about this book and doing things where I meet more people who I otherwise meet, because, like, when I do my show, it's just me and this guy, Rob, who stands in front of the camera, and then there's a guy who's in a robot room who makes the camera move, and that's it. Just me and Rob, every day. That's it. He's the audience. So, like, if Rob giggles, my world is complete. And if he doesn't, that's sort of it. Reminding me that there's somebody other than Rob is good in terms of remembering that, like, not just tailoring my arguments for him.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good for you.
Good. And... I mean, in a way, it's helpful. Like, you can't think about, like, it's like right now, I can't see you guys because there's bright lights. That's really good. If I could see you, I'd go like, eh. So there's mental addition there that helps. But being out in the world and meeting a lot of people who are conservatives or who say they are independents or who are unpersuaded or people who say, you know, I watch with my Republican dad, or I, right. You know, meeting people who don't agree with me, who are watching me anyway, reminds me that if I am trying to get across a point of view, I have to persuade and not assert, because I can't assume that everybody's already agreeing with me when I start to make the funny voice. I can't assume that I'm not going to offend somebody who thinks that person shouldn't be made fun of. And so I try to be sort of ecumenical. I try not to imagine my audience being, the people who are listening to me talk, being people who already agree with me. I, in fact, try to imagine a Republican audience. So that is, I guess it means that I'm really cognizant of it, but I think your feelings about that explain why liberal media is less successful than conservative media.
For sure, yeah.
And I don't think conservatives, I think the conservative media model, the conservative media model involves this one really important step that liberals don't usually use, which is, listen to me, I am the light and the truth and the way, and you have to believe what I say, and everybody else is out to get you, and you can't listen to anybody else, never change the channel,
yeah.
They're trying to kill you.
Right.
Liberals don't say that. Conservatives tell their audience that. Do not watch anything else, it'll destroy your brain. I'm here trying to save you, they're all trying to kill you. That sense of an embattled community that needs to protect itself from somebody who's trying to victimize them is not part of the way that liberals talk in the media.
But even that, it seems to me, I agree, but even that, it seems to me, is that, I mean, conservatives that I've talked to, I tried to write a book with a conservative once, it was a total disaster, but you know, when... we say a phrase like war on women, for instance, and it's eminently clear to one portion of the audience what that means. I actually think to a portion of America, that's very off-putting and upsetting and confusing.
Yes. Yes.
And that, and it's very hard for me to get around, because I don't know, when Rick Santorum is worried about pornography, I don't know what he's talking about. And that's when I feel the country divided, is not when we're both arguing about a problem and we have different solutions. It's when we can't even agree where the problem is.
Yeah.
You know, and that in the same way that I'm dying to hear Republicans say, there's a healthcare crisis and this is what we think we should do, that I know that there's a segment of the American population that says, why isn't the left talking about pornography? You know, and then I just think, like, I guess they should unionize? I don't know. That's the only thing I think. You know, I don't...
Higher taxes on porn would be better. Yeah. Also, if there was light rail to the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah, right.
Be good.
Would really help the blue industry. So I do think that, but that we say that leftist media isn't, you know, doesn't use an attack, doesn't say they're all out to get you, but I actually think some of the language that we use that seems so immediately obvious to our peers actually sounds threatening.
I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. And you know, I think that is in part, I think, linguistic warfare is part of partisan warfare. I mean, it goes back to, I mean, I think the way that we felt it most acutely on the left, I think maybe starting in the 90s, was this whole idea of family values.
Yeah.
Like, okay, family values, awesome. Like, yeah. Especially, like, I had a very specific idea of what that meant. Family meant a really specific thing growing up gay in the San Francisco Bay Area. But that the idea that family values would be a way that you told people that you wanted to deny gay people rights. Such a strange form of code. It didn't even make sense, but it's turned that phrase, that family values phrase, into something that we now use totally devoid of its actual linguistic meaning.
Well, yeah, it's depressing. It's enough to make one want a drink, I believe.
What's in this case?
So we're going to go to a Q&A, but first I'm going to make a drink.
Did I say a magic thing that... made this happen? Did I say a phrase that caused this?
You thought I wasn't thirsty till now? Wow. Really, we got to know each other better. Maddo and I are both cocktail enthusiasts, and I was given this beautiful case.
Oh, my God.
Oh, sorry, there's only two.
Oh, my God.
But I've invented a cocktail inspired by your book. I was going to call the cocktail Drift, but I thought it just seemed kind of Californian. So I'm calling it the Unmooring of American Military Power. and it's pretty easy to make.
Okay.
Which is funny, because that's how easy it was to unmoor American military
exactly.
power.
Exactly. It's not a conspiracy. It's just rye, Cointreau.
It's cognac-based. It's passive or safe if you're kind of a flaky Jew like I am. So for people who have their cocktail sets here, I'll teach you how to make it.
I was wondering what the ice was for
that
back
there.
That's
what the ice is for.
I thought, Daniel needs ice on stage.
You never know.
Quirky.
Where's the little, here it is.
I've never been happier than I am in this moment.
You really are a cheap date.
Just the anticipation
usually,
of this.
Yeah, usually women don't say that until the third drink. So it's a 4-to-1 ratio of cognac here and Cointreau, which is either okay for Passover or isn't, depending on which Jewish blog you read.
Okay.
It was a classic example of really looking for the blog that tells you what you want to know. It was red meat for me. You know, I thought, like, oh, they think I can't have it. Let me go to the other blog. Oh, look. I love the internet.
This blog is genius.
Yeah. These guys are smart.
These guys say it's okay.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a sidecar without the lemon?
No. It's you're so far off. The proportions are a little different. It's based on a cocktail called Scorch the Earth, which I thought sounded appropriate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's four parts cognac and one part Cointreau, and then you are the guest of honor, you may add as many shakes of bitters as you are embittered by the American political process. I think I have another bottle. All right.
I'm never going to have a child, but if I did, I would name the child Angostura. Angus for short, with an O.
No.
I'm so happy. We even have twists.
Yeah, well, it's, you know.
Okay. I didn't know this was going to happen. I would have had such a better day all day long if I knew that at the end of the day, this is going to be what happened.
Well, I had a great week testing the cocktail, you know. Not good enough for her. No, cheers.
Cheers, thank you. The unmooring of American military power. That's really good.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Can I be alone with this?
It tastes a lot better than the unmooring of American political power. Yeah. And they're strong, which I liked, so that you wouldn't say, can I have more unmooring of American military?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
This is just enough. Now let's go back.
Yeah. All right. Eileen asks, in the beginning of your book, you say of Dick Cheney, well, the book is dedicated to Dick Cheney.
Yes.
They used to go out. And it says, you say, oh, please let me interview you.
Yes.
And the question is, if you didn't interview Dick Cheney, what's the first question you would ask him?
Oh, that's good. Well, first I would ask him if me dedicating the book to him is why he finally said yes. Because that would be very... What can I give you, Dick Cheney? I give you this book. I have been trying for a very long time to interview him. I feel like there have been a lot of good interviews with him about his time as vice president. But there is... Can I tell you a little story about Dick Cheney about why I'm interested in him?
Yeah.
Okay. So...
I think that's kind of the whole idea.
Okay. Good point. Excellent. Speaking of the point. Okay. So, Iran-Contra happens. The problem with Iran-Contra, hyphenated scandal about two places that are very far apart from each other that have a very complicated relationship. Seems like a huge scandal and then promptly disappears in a puff of Reagan hagiography. So... The Iran-Contra scandal at the time is a huge deal. Senior administration officials being indicted, being convicted, people going to prison. Reagan was told by Congress, we know what you want to do in South America and in Central America. And we say no, you cannot do it. You cannot do it with this agency. You cannot do it with that agency. You can't do it with any other agency that we can't think of the name of right now. You can't do it by any means, no. And Reagan said, okay, I'll do it in secret. Which was very illegal. What he did was very, very illegal and a huge scandal. And he paid for it by selling arms to the Iranians. And, like, not only was that illegal, but he'd been talking about how he'd never do that. It was a really bad deal. And in order to save Reagan's butt at the end of Iran-Contra, when really it was the scandal that was going to end his presidency, they came up, the administration came up, I think, ad hoc on the spot with this idea that it hadn't really been illegal for Reagan to do these things. Because he's president, and a president can do anything they want on national security, and it's never illegal. It was like Nixon said, when you're the president, if the president does it, it's right. Not illegal. It was the same thing, except it was about war. Anything the president wants to do...
Dick Cheney's here!
Oh, he's here! He said yes! He said yes! He said yes! I always knew this is what it would be
we
like!
We need a third glass.
I know. So they came up with this defense, and Congress investigated Iran-Contra, and they said, are you kidding? That's ridiculous. The president is not constrained by law when it comes to national security. That's ridiculous. That's not the American way that we do things. And there was a dissent from the congressional conclusion on this, who said, actually, the Reagan administration is right. Iran-Contra is fine. That wasn't illegal. The president can do anything regardless of the law and regardless of Congress on national security. I agree with them. And that dissent was from a Wyoming congressman named Dick Cheney. He had a really big idea. And nobody cared at the time because he was this backbench Wyoming Republican and it was this minority report to the Iran-Contra investigation. I have it. I bought it on eBay. But I want to ask him about
that. How much was it?
It was like $100.
Oh.
Yeah, crazy for a government report. But there aren't very many of them around. But he admits, he has said before that he thinks this was an important thing in explaining where he is coming from on politics. But I want to know, did you say that because you were trying to save Reagan's butt too? Did you do that because of short-term political interests? Or did you really already believe in a far-sighted way in a totally unconstrained kingly presidency that can wage war on its own? I honestly don't know what the answer would be, and that's, I think it ended up being really important for our country that he thought that weird way. And therefore that idea of the presidency ended up not being an aberration, but the way we do things now, and I want to know where it came from. So that's what I would ask him.
Wow. Yeah. It's never going to happen, though. But it's great.
I would take any member of the Cheney family. Any of them. I'm assuming they could all answer.
All right, right? Phrase that differently, that you would take any member of the Cheney family, all right? That's just going to...
More thunder.
Someone who doesn't want to tell me their name asks what your prediction is for the outcome of a health care act.
Oh, that's a good question. I'm bad at predictions. So I don't know. But I think that if the court strikes it down in broad terms, with a 5-4 decision, it is going to change the way that Americans think about the court for a very long time. And I think that the court is cognizant of that. I mean, when Justice Roberts gives speeches, like, you know, does the sort of state of the court speech that he does and stuff, he's been talking about his worries about the esteem of the court in the eyes of the American people. And so it seems to be on their mind.
More than, say, it was in 2000.
Yeah. Or after Citizens United, yeah. Right? You know, so I don't know, but if I am optimistic, I want the decision to be not 5-4, because I don't want us to lose faith in the basic systems of our basic structure of
I'm
our government.
You off. Yeah.
I don't know. It's a pretty radical court.
What advice would you give Obama? Very few people put their names, so I'll just pretend this is from my mother. What advice would you give Obama about the world economy on our own, other than firing the banksters who are his advisors? It's kind of a presumptuous question.
What advice would I give Obama on the world economy?
Yeah.
Don't ask Maddow about the world economy. I don't know. I mean, I think that right now, I think that this presidency, weirdly, is going to be so defined by the presidency before it that I'm mostly just curious as to how they're going to approach the second term if they get one. I mean, if you think about it, if you look at the economic indicators when they took over, right? They took over in the middle of us falling off a cliff. It was like Wile E. Coyote, like, it's not like we were just standing here and about to drop. We had already started to drop, and we're at the part where he's reaching out for the little cactuses that are hanging off the cliff, trying to stop his descent. That's where the economy was when this president took over. And with the Iraq war ongoing and the Afghanistan war ongoing, with all these decisions still unmade about you know, how we were going to deal with accountability for things like torture in the previous administration, with a very radical court, I think that the second term, the prospects of a second term, it's not for sure, but the prospects of a second term, more than in other recent presidencies, are going to show us who this president is. I think it has mostly been, you know, it's like somebody throws you a medicine ball. Like, it's going to be a long time before I know
you really are a Californian. Someone throws you a medicine ball. Oh, yeah. Okay. We've all been there.
Somebody throws you a medicine ball, and you spend a long time catching it, right, and backing up. And I feel like they're sort of still backing up. And I'm interested to see what it's going to be like when he tries to throw it back. I don't think they've been able to do much of that.
I worry about a second term myself.
Why?
But I'm for a second term. I think about Clinton's second term, and I think about, a large mechanism to find something, anything, to gum up the works with a second term.
Yeah.
And that, given what has been thrown at him, I mean, plenty has been thrown at Obama that should have been thrown to him, but when I look at the things that have been thrown at him that should not have been, they're really monstrous. And I don't want to know. You know, it's like you read an article about George Zimmerman, and then you read the comments online, and then you really get a taste of it. And I worry about that.
Well, can you imagine how do you imagine avoiding that? That's the problem. It's like
I don't know. I just work here. I have no idea.
I understand the prospect that you are worried about, but I also think that when you see people sort of wounded and lashing out in ways that are ugly, it doesn't make me want them to be in charge.
Oh, no. Not so worried about it. I don't want it to happen.
Right.
But that's what
yeah.
that I think that there's some... I think a second term we would find out more about the president, but the mechanism by which we might, right, might really be monstrous.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a huge Obama supporter, and... I'm enthusiastic about the idea of a second term, but that's my worry, and I feel that there's a often this opinion that's like, oh, in his second term, he's going to go crazy. Like, there's going to be solar energy everywhere, you know, and that I actually think, like, or something horrendously racist that we're all going to have to argue about whether it's racist or not before we even argue about the thing, and then the thing's going to be ridiculous to begin with. Yeah. That's my fear. But I think that
what's going on, the fight within the American right to figure out what kind of Republican Party there is after the George W. Bush era is a really interesting fight. And I don't think it has a predictable outcome at this point. I mean, they didn't pick Rick Santorum. You know, they didn't, they don't seem to be picking Ron Paul. They seem to be picking
Mitt Romney.
Right. And he's the guy who came in second to John McCain, who also didn't end up redefining the party. I think the choice of Mitt Romney essentially sort of kicks down the road the question of what the Republican Party is going to be like and who's the inheritor of the George W. Bush legacy. I mean, it doesn't seem like Mitt Romney represents any one thing so much that he is the new Republican Party.
Right.
And somebody once put it to me that the George W. Bush administration was a tree that, like, cast a lot of shade, a lot of very dense shade, and nothing grew under it. And so just in terms of, like, building a Republican bench, they did not grow a successor. They did not grow even a group of successors. The fact that George W. Bush foreign policy advisors are Mitt Romney's foreign policy advisors is a liability and not an asset. Like, there's nothing that was inherited from the previous Republican Party. So who are they? And I don't hope for the Republican Party to decide that it is just a rump party of crazy. I want there to be good partisan fighting in this country. I want there to be a good, articulate, constructive, policy-based conservative voice in this country, just like I want that on the liberal side, because I want there to be good arguments that you only win if your argument is better. And we're not having smart arguments.
All right. Well, you did a very nice segue into the next question. How did you get so smart? It says nature or nurture below it, if you want to...
I don't feel that smart. I don't know. I don't feel that smart. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. Thank you for the premise of the question. How's that?
Well, maybe this leads into this. How did living in the Bay Area shape your views, and what do you miss most about San Francisco?
I love San Francisco, and every time I come back here, I remember that this is the only city in America that has magic in it. That there is... and I'm sure some other people from some other parts of the country feel that way about their city. I mean, I know friends from New Orleans who feel that way about New Orleans, but I go there and I don't feel it the way that I feel it here. And it's, in part, I think it may be evolutionarily devised response to the fact that there are lots of vistas in San Francisco. Like, we have hills, so you can see far from a lot of places unexpectedly.
Which is part of the radical vision of San Francisco.
Yeah.
Which I love.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's the vision of John Muir. I live near several hills that you climb to the top of them and there's nothing but scruffy grass and rocks and you can't believe they're not condos. And they're not condos because a couple people said, let's never build something on here. And everybody else said, like, that's a hilarious idea. Who would ever build there? Like, go whatever you want. Go for it. And, you know, and the whole city gets the last laugh.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome.
And to be constrained on three sides by water and to build within that and to have the kind of, just the kind of light and heat that is generated by being here is something that I miss all the time.
So, and the Mexican food. You forgot the Mexican food.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I'm actually already, having only been back in town for like 6 hours, I'm already half burrito. Because of my metabolism. Yeah. I don't think of myself as an activist in terms of what I do now. Since I started doing media full time, I was an activist and then I stopped doing that in order to do media. But I do think that having been an activist for all of my adult life before I started doing media absolutely changed who I am and shaped how I think about the world. Like, a lot of politics is covering activists who are trying to get stuff done, and I feel like I have pretty good instinct into whether or not people are doing a good job at trying to accomplish something politically, because I've tried to accomplish things politically too.
Well, would you say this is an activist book? This is the question kind of someone asked.
Your
book has important information. Is it also a call to action?
It has more of an agenda than I do on TV. It does. I am making an argument and saying that a thing should be different in the world than is now.
Were you worried that undermined the choice to leave activism behind in favor of media?
I think it might be why I felt like I couldn't do that in broadcast. Why I couldn't make the argument in broadcast. Because I do actually have a prescription. Here's a thing that I think ought to be different in the world. And that's not how I'm... people think that sometimes that's how I approach media, but it's not. Like, what I see my role in TV is explaining the world, explaining what's going on, and you can make of it what you will. But this is me saying that there is something about our world that ought to be changed. And that is a different thing. And I'm not sure that I've done that since I was an activist. But growing up as a gay kid in the Bay Area, you know, I graduated from high school in the class of 1990. And growing up at that time, I mean, the AIDS epidemic and the AIDS activist movement responding to it was the thing that shaped my adulthood. I mean, it shaped my sense of who I am as a person. And that is something that you cannot explain to people who didn't live it and didn't go through it. And so... I mean, I don't know how it made me who I am, but I know it made me who I am.
One of the most poignant parts of Drift for me was you, an Iraq veteran, said that he thought the problem with kind of military families and the reserves and the guard being permanent and the effect that our military policy has had on that is like AIDS 30 years ago.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that was that really moved me too when he said it.
I think I got the
As the country learned to be untroubled by the fact that we had troops at war, troops coming home from those wars learned to look out for themselves. Quote, it's like AIDS was 30 years ago, Iraq veteran Paul Rykoff told me in 2011. It's a huge crisis for us, but no one else in the country thinks they're us. No one even thinks they're like us.
And I think you can't sit in this theater and not be electrified by that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's one more order of business that is at the end of all of these Inform presentations. And I personally think that you should have another sip or two before that.
What kind of business?
Yeah. all of the guests are asked the following question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? Let me just give a little...
Can I do two 30-second ideas?
How about six 10-second ideas? How about 12 5-second ideas?
Two 30-second ideas. Number one... Stop treating the CIA as a branch of the military and have a big debate about it that would allow the American public to weigh in on what we want our military to be like. Two, stop calling anything that does not consist primarily of gin and dry vermouth a martini.
Yeah. Right there. Yeah. That's my wife right there. Yeah, I married a vodka martini drinker, and it's been a real struggle for me.
You married actually a vodka drinker. There's no such thing as a vodka martini drinker.
This is the compromise I've made. I'm no longer an activist. I'm a husband, and so that's what I mean. Yeah, you can't sit in this theater and not be electrified by the notion. All right, thank you very much. It's been a tremendous evening. Please give a huge hand to Rachel Maddow. I believe you're getting an ovation.
Thank you, man. Thank you.